Well, this morning we are in 1 Samuel chapter 20, and it's the, I call it Blood Brothers. It's the story of David and Jonathan, but really this morning what we're going to focus on even more than David and Jonathan is Saul and Jonathan. And the reason I'm going to focus on there is because I think the story of Saul and Jonathan powerfully illustrates some of the dynamics that most of us deal with when dealing with family of origin issues. Because the reality is, every single one of us comes from a fallen, broken family system. That there has never been a family, going all the way back to Adam and Eve, that didn't have brokenness in it. And as a result of that brokenness, things are not as they should be. But to remind you of a phrase I coined many years ago in our recovery ministry, we don't know how things are supposed to be. We only know what we know. And so the phrase I coined many years ago that I have used in countless situations, in groups, in counseling, in teaching and preaching, is the phrase, normal is what you know, no matter how screwed up it is. And then I would put a little tag on the end of that is, and we spend most of our life trying to get back to normal. And so what happens so much of the time in our own thinking is we have these distortions, we have this dysfunctional thinking that we don't even realize we have because it was pressed upon us in early childhood and then continued to be added on throughout the rest of our lives. And I think we see this very powerfully in the story of Saul and Jonathan. But before we get into that, let's remind ourselves just of the context, what leads us up to this story. And the context, and remember, we are in this series, the story of David in the light of addiction and recovery. And where it begins, really, is with God choosing Saul and then rejecting Saul because of Saul's unwillingness to accept God's sovereignty. And we see that God rejected Saul really because of two primary events. The first was in 1 Samuel chapter 13, when instead of waiting on Samuel to offer the sacrifice, he does it himself and then defends his actions. And then in chapter 15 is when he fails to destroy the Amalekites as he was specifically instructed, and once again defends his actions. And as a result of that, Samuel tells him very clearly, your kingdom will not last, God tells Saul through Samuel, your kingdom will not last, I will give it to another. And of course, that other that he is speaking of is David. And so in chapter 17, we have the story of David killing the giant Goliath. And out of that, David becomes this kind of legendary myth sort of man. And so much so that in 18 verse 7 it says the women sang his praises, singing, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. Which of course sends an insecure narcissist of Saul into a tailspin of jealousy. And so in chapters 18 and 19, we see Saul's jealousy and paranoia lead him to start playing his favorite dinner game, which was pin the spear on David. And so on two occasions, Saul throws a spear at David, and David both times narrowly escapes without a scratch. And then in chapter 19, in the last passage we looked at, Saul makes multiple attempts on David's life. He orders David's death. But Saul's son, Jonathan, intervenes because of his intimate friendship with David and his respect for David and for what David has done for the kingdom of Israel. Saul initially relents of his death wish for David, but then he sends men to kill David at his home. Saul's men, however, find David with Samuel and the prophets and have the Spirit of God come upon them so they can do nothing but join the prophets in prophesying. And so in a very comedic section, you have Saul sending men to kill David, and every time they get there, they all start prophesying, And so finally, after multiple attempts, Saul, in essence, throws up his arms and says, fine, I'll do it myself. But even Saul, when he arrives at Naoth, ends up losing his faculties to the spirit of prophecy. And David, once again, is protected and safe from Saul's wrath. And so that brings us to chapter 20. And chapter 20 is Samuel is Jonathan's denial and the story of David and Jonathan and their blood brother friendship. So let's begin, first of all, with the appeal to a friend in verses 1 through 3. It says, then David fled from Naoth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, what have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to kill me? Now, let's think about this for a minute, though. Think of the risk that David takes here. King Saul wants him dead. I think that has been made abundantly clear by now. And yet, look who David turns to. King Saul wants him dead, and David turns to the king's son. Well, think about it. Why does Saul want David dead? Because he sees him as a threat to his throne. Now, if Saul sees David as a threat to his throne, where does that leave Jonathan? I mean, if you think about it, Jonathan has even more to gain from David's demise than Saul. Saul is the established king, and dethroning him, in spite of his dysfunctions, in spite of how much the people love David, would be a difficult task. Yet think about what happens when the inevitable eventually happens. When Saul dies, and there is that transition that naturally in kingship is supposed to go from father to son, that is when that transition would take place. And so the most likely time for radical change in leadership is at the transition of power from Saul to Jonathan. And so when you think about it, David takes this incredible risk of going to the king's son asking what's going on here, when it's really Jonathan who has the most to gain through David's demise. Yet David takes the risk. Why? Because he knows his friend. Look at verse 2. Never, Jonathan replied, you are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so. Now, do you see Jonathan's denial here? It's as if he's saying, yeah, I know my dad's a little off his rocker. I know he's got a temper. I know he's lost it a couple times with you. And yeah, I did see the spear hole in the wall. But dad's not really like that. And I think he's okay now. It was just a momentary blip. And if he isn't, and if he is still wanting to kill you, he surely would have told me. I mean, can you see the denial here? I mean, Saul has made it abundantly clear. He is out to kill David. And yet Jonathan is stuck in denial, saying, no, no, my dad's not like that. He wouldn't do that. Look at verse 3. But David took an oath and said, your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said to himself, Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only a step between me and death. David is saying, Jonathan, wake up and smell the coffee. You didn't see the look in his eyes right before he threw the spear. You didn't see him come to Naoth looking for my head on a platter. I'm not getting anywhere near your father unless or and until I see definitive proof of change. And yet Jonathan still doesn't quite get it. And so notice the plan they come up with. Look at verse 4. Jonathan said to David, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you. So David said, look, tomorrow is the new moon feast. and I'm supposed to dine with the king. But let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him, David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan. If he says, very well, then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, you can be sure that he is determined to harm me. Now, notice the plan is fairly simple. It's a testing of the waters. Saul expects David to be at his table for the new moon festival. But let's think about that for a second. How well does that add up? Don't you think about it? It's a little strange that Saul has made multiple attempts on David's life, and yet David is still expected to show up for the holiday? Saul has thrown spears at David twice, sent men to kill him on four separate occasions, and traveled to Naoth to do it himself. But now that we have a holiday, the whole family is supposed to sit down together, smile for the camera, and pretend everything is hunky-dory. That kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? Kind of sounds like some families we know of, doesn't it? Normal is what you know, no matter how screwed up it is. David's plan is to see how Saul responds to his absence. If Saul meets his absence with understanding, then maybe, just maybe, he's truly had a change of heart. If he responds in anger, then we know nothing has really changed. In fact, think about it this way. Saul's just had this powerful religious spiritual experience, right? He went to Naoth to kill David, ended up prophesying instead. So could you imagine the narrative being, oh, well, yeah, I'm not mad at David anymore. I had this God encounter, and now everything is fine. Everything is wonderful. Yeah. Well, look at verse 8. David goes on. As for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I am guilty, then kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father? David's saying, look, if I'm going to die, I'd rather you kill me than your father. Jonathan, verse 9. Never. If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you? In essence, David turns to Jonathan and says, if anyone's going to kill me, I'd rather it be you. And Jonathan turns and says, no, no, it's not like that. Verse 9, if I had the least inkling. Well, question, how big does the bottle of ink has to be before Jonathan gets an inkling out of it? What does it take for Jonathan to break through his denial and see his father clearly? You see, folks, there is a deep innate resistance within all of us to look honestly at our family's dysfunctions. And Jonathan is holding on to that for dear life. Verse 10, David asked, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? Come, Jonathan said, let's go out to the field. So they went there together. You see, David understands that Jonathan can't just leave the table and come to him. He knows that if Jonathan gets up from the feast table, that his father is going to be suspicious. His father's likely to follow him or have men following him. He knows that Saul will likely try to use Jonathan to get to him. So notice where it comes up next. Look at verse 12. Notice the covenant of friendship. Then Jonathan said to David, I swear by the Lord, the God of Israel, that I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he is favorably disposed towards you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father intends to harm you, may the Lord deal with Jonathan, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away in peace. Once again, remember, who has the most to gain by David's death? Yet notice the intensity and the passion of Jonathan's covenant with David. Notice also it appears that Jonathan knows that David will be the next king of Israel. Look at verse 13, the end of verse 13. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father, but show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family. Not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Jonathan, in essence, says, David, I know you are God's anointed, and I know you will be the next king. I know my father wants to kill you, but I know that God will protect you. Therefore, please remember me and my descendants when you become king. Remember, the standard procedure when a new king takes power is to do what? Kill all his rivals. Jonathan saying, David, remember me when you become king. Look at verse 16. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. You know, this is the original blood brother oath. You know, most men, most guys grew up and we had that, you know, that romantic notion of, you know, you have a best friend and you cut your hand and you put them together and you do that blood brother thing that we saw in movies, or I'm not sure where it came from. Well, David and Jonathan are the original blood brothers. And think about it. Here are two men who should be enemies, who instead love each other with a love that is greater than a devotion of a son to a father. Yet they still have to work out a plan. They still have to work out some more details. So notice the code they come up with, starting in verse 18. Then Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon feast. You will be missed because your seat will be empty. The day after tomorrow, toward evening, go to the place where you hid when this trouble began and wait by the stone easel. I will shoot three arrows to the side of it as though I were shooting at a target. Then I will send a boy and say, go, find the arrows. If I say to him, look, the arrows are on this side of you, bring them here, then come. Because as surely as the Lord lives, you are safe. There is no danger. But if I say to the boy, look, the arrows are beyond you, then you must go, because the Lord has sent you away. And about the matter you and I discussed, remember, the Lord is witness between you and me forever. Jonathan, in essence, says, I know it may not be safe for us to communicate directly. So I'm going to communicate through a normal activity. And this is the code they have. Well, notice how the truth comes out. Look at verse 24. Notice the unveiling of truth. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon feast came, the king sat down to eat. He sat down in his customary place by the wall opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul, but David's place was empty. Again, notice, it's a holiday, so everything is, quote, normal. It's holiday, so we pretend there's no struggles, etc., etc. But David's seat is empty. I wonder, you think the thought ever came to Saul's mind? I wonder if it could have anything to do with the spears I've thrown at him lately. No, because look at verse 26. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought, something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he is unclean. I mean, just think about that for a minute. Saul has made multiple attempts to kill David, but when David doesn't show up for the holiday meal, he goes, huh, something must be up in David's world. Okay? First day, no problem, I'll ignore that. Saul notices David's gone, but assumes he must have become unclean and will have to go through the ceremony and will be at his place tomorrow. Then look at verse 27. But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Okay, again, notice the obliviousness of the abuser. The abuser has no clue why someone he has abused would avoid an interaction with him. But also, think about what do you think goes through Jonathan's mind when his father, the king, asks about David's absence when he is part of the plan of setting this trap and figuring things out. Question. What do you think Saul's countenance is like? Do you think Jonathan knows his father well enough to see the seething anger that lies just beneath the surface? Can you imagine how terrifying this place must be for Jonathan? He knows he's about to tell his father a lie and set a trap for him. Set a trap so that his father will reveal his true intentions and what's really going on inside of him. Can you imagine doing that with your father? Now imagine what that'd be like if your father was the king, the most powerful man in the country. Through the years, I've been in different situations where individuals have stood up to their father about something. And I've seen grown, strong men just tremble even at the thought of saying no to their father. Imagine what it was like for Jonathan. Well, look at verse 28. Jonathan answered, "David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go because my family is observing a sacrifice in the town and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away to see my brothers.' That is why he has not come to the king's table." Well, question. How convincing do you think Jonathan was able to tell his rehearsed speech? My guess is that he'd rehearsed the answer over and over and probably gave it right on the edge of trembling. And notice Saul's response, verse 30. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die." Well, first of all, notice that much of what Saul says is true. Jonathan has sided with David. And David is a threat to Jonathan's reign. But notice all the venom. Notice also the venom. The attempt to shame and appeal to power that Saul gives Jonathan. You know, in one breath, he calls him a son of a perverse and wicked woman. And in the next breath, he says, "And you're bringing shame on her." You see, it doesn't add up. Realize how easy it would have been for Jonathan to cave to his father and tell him exactly where David is hiding. Even right now, in this point in the story, Jonathan has the choice to appease his father or risk everything and protect David. Even now, Jonathan has the choice to betray David, appease his father, and protect his future kingdom. Or he can stand up to Dad. How terrifying is it to stand up to Dad, especially when Dad is in a fit of rage? Especially if Dad is king. the same king of Israel who basically looked Samuel in the eye, the almighty prophet, the one that the people in Bethlehem were terrified when they heard that he was coming, and said to the said prophet, "I'm king, I can do whatever I want." And yet look at Jonathan's courageous defense of his friend. Look at verse 32. "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Saul graduates from his game of pin the spear on David to the game of spearing his own son. In a fit of rage, he picks up his spear and he throws it at close range at his very own son. Yet I'm beginning to wonder about Saul's ability to throw a spear. He's 0 for 3 at very close range. But notice that Jonathan finally sees the truth clearly. It took a spear being thrown at him at close range, but he finally sees it. Look at the end of verse 33. "Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David." Well, it's about time you figured that out, Jonathan. Verse 34. "Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. On that second day of the feast, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David." I want you to notice two verbs here very closely. Jonathan was angered and grieved. Both words are very healthy, natural, God-given responses to his father's sin and rebellion. God gave us our emotions, even strong negative emotions, for legitimate purposes and reasons. And here is a good example. The primary loss that Jonathan has to grieve is the illusion of who he thought his father was. He grieves the loss of the father he thought he had, as well as the loss of his friendship with David. And grieving is the appropriate response. He is angry. And anger, the emotion of anger, what it does is it gives us power to move in passion about the things that are important to us. Jonathan's relationship with David was extremely important to him. And David's honor was important to Jonathan. And now that his father has, the denial has finally been broken and Jonathan sees his father's true intent for David, Jonathan is angry about it. And he wants to take action. And he's grieving the losses. And just think about what horrible losses it was. Wonder what would have happened if David and Jonathan would have been able to remain friends. We don't know what communication there was between David and Jonathan from this point forward, but we know it was limited, if at all. But do you realize that David and Jonathan had the kind of relationship, and Jonathan appeared to have the humility that Jonathan, I think, could have allowed David to take the throne, and they could have worked together? Could you imagine the witness that would be? But they are never together again like they once were. And for that, Jonathan grieves. Well, notice the communication of danger, verse 35 through 40. "In the morning, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. He had a small boy with him. And he said to the boy, 'Run and find the arrows as I shoot.' As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out after him, "Isn't the arrow beyond you?" Then he shouted, and I can't help but imagine an emphasis here, "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing about all this, only Jonathan and David knew. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go, take them back to town." So Jonathan follows through with his promise to David. He tested his father, and his father failed miserably. And now he communicates that clearly to David. Did you catch the urgency in his words? "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." I can't help but picture Jonathan crying as he says that, hoping that he never sees David again, though he longs to be with him. Because he finally sees clearly what's actually happening. But notice that David doesn't flee immediately. Notice instead of heeding his friend's advice, he comes back to his friend. And notice the parting of friends in verse 41. After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Again, notice the risk that David takes. Even now, Jonathan could kill David and regain his status with his father instantly. They then kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me and between our descendants, your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left, and Jonathan went back to the town. Do you see the bitterness and tragedy in their parting? Two men who could have joined forces and led Israel in a powerful way. But because of Saul's dysfunction, because of Jonathan's father's dysfunction, they part ways and live separate lives. It really is a tragedy. But what does it say to you and me? I think it says a lot. And the first point I want to make is that denial runs deep, especially in relation to our family of origin. Again, how much did Jonathan know about his father's initial attempts to kill David? My guess is he heard the rumors. I mean, think about it. The king's palace may be big, but it's always a place of rampant gossip. Saul threw spears at David twice. You know, Saul hears, you know, it's Jonathan hears the story and he looks up at the dining room, room, and he sees a big hole in the wall where a spear hit. One, two, three. Oh, yeah, there's three holes up there. You know, that kind of fits that story I've been hearing. Saul sent men to drag David out of his sickbed to kill him. He made no attempts to hide his actions. He sent three different groups of men to Naoth to kill David, and when they all failed, he went himself. There's no way Jonathan could have missed all of that, except for one thing. When we live in denial, we fail to see what is often so obvious to everyone around us. In spite of all the ample evidence, Jonathan still struggled to believe that his father could really want David dead. Can you hear the excuses of those around the abuser? Yet the evidence was plainly there. But Jonathan struggled to believe his father was going to do what his father was trying to do. Why? Because no one wants to see their parents in such an ugly light. It hurts us deeply when we see the brokenness of our parents that we work very, very hard to find ways not to see it. It never ceases to amaze me how often I hear stories of abuse, stories of neglect, stories of bad treatment, yet people don't see it. Why? Because normal is what you know, no matter how screwed up it is. Because we're so comfortable in it. Because it's all we have known. It's another reason why being in community is so important. It's why telling our stories is so important. It's amazing how many times somebody will be telling their story and they think it's just a funny story, a normal story, and then they see the looks on other people's faces and all of a sudden it clicks. Huh. Maybe that wasn't so normal. Denial runs deep. Yet if we want to change, if we want to grow, we have to honestly face the truth. We have to see things for what they truly are. But then secondly, need to see from this story that abusers don't change simply with words. Why do you think Jonathan thought things were different? My guess is because Saul said they were. Again, think about it. David had a place at the holiday meal. If my dad was still actively trying to kill David, he wouldn't have set a place at the table for him. Of course not. And I can't help but imagine that Saul had put the word out, or maybe even told Jonathan, that his religious experience of, quote, prophesying at the end of chapter 19 had caused him to see the light and that he was no longer angry with David. If we ever heard that story before. How many times have you heard of abusers, quote, finding God, having a powerful spiritual experience and being delivered from their destructive answer and say everything is different now? And folks, please don't misunderstand me. I believe God is capable of doing that. I believe at times He does do that. But you know what? When He does do that, the individuals for whom He does that for understand why people are still afraid of Him. And they're not defensive and angry because people still have boundaries, that people still are being careful in their approach. Because when God does that kind of miraculous change of someone's heart, they see the ugliness for what it was, and they just have a mercy and a graciousness that says, you know, I've done some horrible things. And any connection you have with me, I understand that's God's grace and mercy, and I understand why you could still be afraid. But how many times have we heard of abusers who say they've had this powerful experience and those things are no longer a problem for them anymore and just want everything to go back to, quote, normal? Come have a seat at the Thanksgiving table. Pretend everything is fine. Abusers' actions don't change just because their words change. Abusers live in a verbal reality. They say it, therefore it must be true. Abusers don't change just because their words do. Those who work with battered wives often talk about how a man beats up the wife in a fit of rage and then shows up the next day or even later that night with roses and contrite words of, I'm so sorry, I will never do that again. But until an individual deals with the seething turmoil beneath the surface, until they deal with the pressure building up inside of them in the pressure cooker, nothing really changes, and it's just a matter of time until the next explosion. You know, I can remember as a kid, my grandmother used to cook beans in a pressure cooker on the stove. And I remember coming in, hearing the noise in the house, in the kitchen, the and, you know, being a kid, you go, you got a curiosity, see what the noise is. You see it's the pressure cooker, and there's Grandma saying, don't touch it. And whatever you do, don't cap off the steam. Why? Because if you block off that steam, then eventually the pressure is going to get so bad that a pressure cooker becomes its own little miniature bomb. And it goes off. Folks, many people are that way. And so they are internal pressure cookers, and the pressure builds and builds and builds, and then some trigger pops the balloon, and it all just comes out in one explosive thing. And then guess what happens once that comes out? Oh, well, they feel better. They don't feel as angry. And then they say, oh, I'm fine now. No, I'm not mad about that anymore, and I'm so sorry for the way I did that, and it'll never happen again. But guess what? The heat's still there. And the pressure is starting to rebuild immediately. Abusers don't change simply by words. They must deal with what is bringing the heat. And then third, I think we can see from this story that abusers often justify their actions by claiming to have our best interests at heart. Verse 31, Saul says, as long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. In other words, he's saying, son, I'm trying to kill your best friend, but I'm doing it for your sake. You don't have enough sense to see the danger right in front of you, so I'll take care of it for you. Of course, that was immediately preceded by Saul calling Jonathan the son of a perverse and rebellious woman and heaping tons of shame on him. In one breath, he tells him that his mother is horrible, and the next he tells him that he's making his mom look bad. Abusers will use all sides of the coin to speak out loud the voice of shame that is so often playing its repeated tapes in the back of our head. And unfortunately, this pattern is all too common among abusers. How many workaholic and absent fathers have defended working 70, 80 hours a week by saying things like, I did it for the family. I did it so we could have that nice house. I did it so you could go to college. I did it so we could take great summer vacations. When the reality is they worked so many hours because they were seeking their validation through success and accomplishment. And many times were working very hard to avoid the very place where they felt most inadequate in the realm of relationships. So it's easier to go to work, stay absent, stay away than to face the struggle. But they, quote, did it for us. And if you aren't thankful for it, then there's something wrong with you because you are the son or daughter of a perverse and rebellious woman. Abusers often justify themselves by claiming to have our best interest at heart. But like Jonathan, we must see through the lies and see the truth. But then next, we must grieve the sins of our parents. Verse 34, Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. On that second day of the feast, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. In order to break generational sins and cycles, we must grieve the sins of our parents and our family before us. However, in order to grieve the sin, we first must allow God to break through our denial so that we can see it clearly. Jonathan had layer upon layer of denial to get through. But once he saw his father clearly, his response was appropriate. He was angry and he was sad. He was angry and he grieved deeply. And you and I must do the same thing. Our parents' sins against us and against others cannot be swept under the rug, because when they are swept under the rug, they are carried from their house to our house and on to future generations. No, it's not necessarily our place to confront or try to make everything right, but we must remove the blinders from our eyes to see the reality of where their brokenness led them. Otherwise, we will repeat the pattern and hand those very attitudes down to our children, grandchildren, etc. Jonathan's anger and grief were healthy and righteous responses to his father's sin. And the same thing is true for you and me. Don't listen to Satan's and many times your own family's lies that say your anger or your grief for their sin is somehow a betrayal of the family. How many families have that rule that we don't talk about our struggles with anyone else? The reality is we must grieve it appropriately or else we repeat it. And closely connected to that, we must use our healthy anger to move us to action. Jonathan used his anger, his righteous and healthy anger, to empower him to act, to give him the courage to stand up to his father, to give him the courage to go out and save David. And we must do the same thing. For many years now, I've been teaching wives that they must use their anger over their husband's sexual sins to move them to places of action. It isn't enough to simply tell a sexually addicted man that he has to stop watching porn. The anger a wife feels in that place is a healthy response, because she wants her marriage to be real. She wants real intimacy. She wants a relationship of exclusivity, and those are healthy and good desires. Her anger to kick him out of the bedroom or even out of the house until he gets healthy is a good thing for her and for him. We have to allow healthy anger to give us the strength to move into the scary places and do what needs to be done. And that's really difficult to do, especially when it's connected to our families of origin. Which leads me to my last point. We must choose good friends over evil family members. And no, I'm not saying that all parents are bad, that all family is bad, or if you are in addiction or dysfunctions, that means all your family is bad. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that we all have to look for healthy community that supports us in our journeys. All of us come from broken families, from broken, dysfunctional places where we learn things wrongly. Now, most parents truly attempt to do the best they can in regards to their children. However, all parents are fallen and broken and therefore fail to love their children well. As I'm getting older, as my kids are becoming adults, I see that more and more clearly in my own journey. As much as I've wanted to love my kids well, there have been many ways that I have not. And they are going to have to go through this themselves. And that isn't saying that I'm a horrible father or that I've blown it in every way, but I have blown it in many ways. And sometimes parents, like Saul, cross boundaries that cannot be ignored, cannot be swept under the rug, but must be addressed directly. Jonathan had an incredibly difficult choice. Do I give in to my crazy father, or do I protect my relationship with my best friend? Do I choose my dad, or do I choose David? Do I honor my father by standing by him even though I know he's crazy, or do I risk everything and stand for truth and for my friendship with David, knowing that it will lead to rejection? After all, standing up to him momentarily has already led to a spear whizzing by my head. Jonathan chose to protect David and his relationship with him, even at the risk of his own life and at the risk of his father's rejection. And I wish I could say this story is unique, but we have seen it many, many times. We have seen many times in our recovery groups where individuals get to places where they must choose between their brothers and sisters in recovery or their family. And unfortunately, many times we see individuals cave into the crazy demands and pressure of their family and walk away from recovery. Thankfully, many times we see individuals choose to set appropriate boundaries with their family and maintain them even when their family rails against them. It's incredibly painful. Yet the growth that comes when individuals honestly face the truth about who their family was and or is, the results are often amazing. And like Jonathan, we often have those choices. Do I stand for truth, or do I continue to keep the secret, continue to maintain the lies? Our choice this morning is, who do we want to be? Do we want to be like Saul and continue the cycles? Or do we want to be like Jonathan and to step into those places, even though they are scary and difficult and hard? But they are life-giving. Let's pray. Father, we come to you this morning and we just thank you for this story, for the realness of it, for the earthiness of it, for the brutal honesty of it. And as we look at Jonathan, Lord, I think most of us can identify with what a terrifying place that would be to choose between a healthy friend and an unhealthy father. And yet, Lord, most of us have had to do that in different ways. And whether our parents are still alive or if they've passed, there are still so many things in our stories that need to be dealt with, need to be worked through, and that we need to break free from the dysfunctions of our families of origin so that we can take the good things we've gotten from them, but not the bad. And so, Lord, I just lift up everyone listening to this message that they would see things a little more clearly and that they would stand by truth. Because, Lord, denial is such a deadly place. So we ask that you deliver us from it. And we ask that reluctantly because truth is often very scary. But it does indeed set us free. And it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Folks, as we leave today, let me just remind you that denial, while tempting, keeps us stuck, keeps us trapped, keeps us in our cages. The truth sets us free. So as we leave this place today, let me just encourage you to open your eyes and let God lead you into truth. and the freedom that comes with it. And with that, we are dismissed.